It's here and now. President Bush spoke from the White House today, midday East Coast time, on this, the fourth anniversary of the start of the war in Iraq, saying that war can be won. The president also said he received an update earlier today from Iraqi Prime Minister Nouri al-Maliki and General David Petraeus, the U.S. commander in Iraq.
Prime Minister Maliki and General Petraeus emphasized that the Baghdad security plan is still in its early stages. And success will take months, not days or weeks.
In a moment, we'll speak to an Iraqi Kurd who was there at the start and is frustrated at the four-year point. But joining us now to talk about military strategy in Iraq is Andrew Basevich, professor of international relations at Boston University. His most recent book, The New American Militarism, How Americans Are Seduced by War. Andrew, first of all, what jumped out at you after today's statement from the president?
Well, I think that was a good clip that you just played. What jumped out at me is, first of all, emphasizing that the surge is still in its early stages, that this is going to take months before we have any sense of whether or not it's going to produce results. He said that not all of the U.S. troops to participate in the surge will be there. I think the second thing is he said at one point that really the mission now is, quote, helping Iraqis to secure their capital. To use an old German military term, Baghdad has become the Schwerpunkt. This is the center of the effort. It's clear that the administration perceives that if the security situation in Baghdad cannot be turned around, then the situation truly looks dire.
Well, in fact, we're going to have some numbers from a new poll that shows that Iraqis feel the situation is dire. The numbers have plummeted from their sense of optimism a couple of years ago. And the new poll also shows that 51% of Iraqis say that violence against U.S. forces is acceptable. That's up from 17% who felt that way in 2004. Among Sunni Arabs, more than 90% feel violence against U.S. forces is, again, acceptable. Obviously, this poses a military challenge.
Well, it's a military challenge, but it's a political issue, too. I mean, the president used the term, the president said that if we can achieve security in Baghdad, then that paves the way, that could permit reconciliation. That's the term he used. It's also a term that in recent days, General Petraeus and Secretary of Defense Gates has used. Reconciliation implies somehow, you know, bringing groups together and settling differences. And the kind of data that you cite from polls suggests to me that the situation has become so radicalized that it becomes very difficult to understand how this reconciliation process can succeed.
Andrew, I'm going to ask you to do something tough in about a minute. Sum up your thoughts on strategy. This was billed as a strategy statement. Some are seeing the president's recent surge as a real stay the course. But you say that there was once a grand strategy of completely changing U.S. policy in the region, and in fact, that's been greatly reduced recently.
Well, that's what's really striking. What's striking is the narrow frame of reference within which the president and others now talk about this situation. I mean, we're 4 years into the war, and we're really talking about, can we secure the capital of this city?
And not put American bases in Iraq and completely redesign it.
When we began the war, the talk in the administration was that, you know, Iraq was really phase one in a larger project, that the transformation of Iraq, democratization of Iraq, pacification of Iraq, would somehow lead to phase two and three and four in the region. That was the strategy to win the global war on terror by transforming the Islamic world. That kind of language has gone away. The strategy now is not even a positive strategy. We're not fighting in order to achieve good things. If you listen to the president's speech, we're fighting, we're continuing to fight in order to prevent things from becoming even worse. We must stay, he says, because otherwise Iraq becomes a terrorist haven.
A greatly reduced plan. Andrew Basevich, professor of international relations at Boston University, thanks as always.
Thank you.
Well, that poll we were speaking of, conducted for ABC News, USA Today, and others, says that the number of Iraqis who say their own life is going well has fallen from 71% in November 2005 to 39% today. 95% 85% of people in Baghdad don't feel safe. But that differs sharply from people in Kurdistan, where 79% of the Kurds say they feel very safe. Well, one Kurd worries that this is false optimism. Joining us now, 28-year-old Ayub Nouri, an Iraqi journalist from the Iraqi region of Kurdistan. He's now studying at Columbia University. Ayub, welcome.
Thank you very much.
Well, you were 24 years old at the time of the U.S. invasion, covering Iraq for the London-based Global Radio News. When you realized that the U.S. was going to invade, what did you think about that?
I was worried that George W. Bush and the whole coalition forces will change their mind about going into war with Iraq. I wanted the war to happen. I wanted Saddam's regime overthrown at that time.
Of course, as we said, you were a Kurd. You lived in Kurdistan. He had committed genocide against the Kurds. It would be an understandable feeling that you would want to have him removed.
Yes, exactly. But my only feeling was not about Kurdistan, because I knew people all over Iraq, in the center and south of Iraq as well, were victims of Saddam's policies and the successive wars he led the country into.
So you had fears in the days leading up to the invasion that George W. Bush would change his mind. Did you have also fears about what an invasion might feel like?
In reality, the idea of war did not scare me. I think many Iraqis were not scared either, because we were all used to wars. We lived all our lives in war, and we knew what's bombing like and what is war like. So we thought, if this is going to be the end of all wars, let it happen.
Well, now, where were you during the invasion? How much did you see?
I was in the north. I was covering the war from two battle lines, one in Kirkuk and the other one in Mosul, where the Iraqi army came under heavy bombardment. Most of the time I was standing next to the American special forces, American spotters that guided the jet fighters where to throw their bombs and everything. Sometimes even they gave me their binoculars to look at the spot where the bomb was going to be thrown. So I saw with my own eyes the bombings and the defeat of the Iraqi army lines from two front lines when the war started.
You're a reporter. What were other Iraqis doing?
In the lead-up to the war, people left the cities in the north of Iraq because they were afraid that when Saddam Hussein's regime is cornered by the Allied forces, Saddam will use whatever weapons he had at his disposal, including chemical or biological weapons. And Kurdish people in the north had a previous experience with chemical attacks. Mm-hmm. So they carried their luggage, equipment, tents, and enough food to tide them over a week or two, and they went to the mountains to hide, expecting a war. This is what happened in the north. And in the south, when the regime fell and I traveled to other parts of Iraq as the cities fell, I saw people coming back into town, and I asked them. They said they were hiding in the villages or in the desert where they had some family, because they knew such isolated or remote places wouldn't be targeted as much as the military camps in the suburbs of the cities or the government institutions inside the cities.
Well, that was 4 years ago, but I'm just wondering if it feels like a lifetime ago.
It does, actually. It doesn't feel like a lifetime ago, because it wasn't something that happened in 4 years ago and it ended then, because it has been going on until now, and I have lived through the war until this moment. I still think it was yesterday, because if it had ended then, I would have thought it was a lifetime ago.
How do you feel about the outcome of the war now?
It's very disappointing, actually, because what made me be a strong supporter of the war, as well as many other Iraqis, was that, as I said, we Iraqi people tried a few times through coup d'etats or uprisings to overthrow the regime, but thousands of people paid with their lives to overthrow that regime, and they couldn't do anything. So this idea that Americans will be able to get rid of him, and second of all, Iraqi people heard many promises on behalf of George W. Bush and other countries that they are going to overthrow Saddam, Iraq will be a free country, there will be economic boom, and there will be freedom as well. So all of these things together added to the hope of Iraqis, I was one of them, that we wanted war. But now, as 4 years have passed over the war and I look back, I see nothing has changed and more people have been killed in the past 4 years. It's a disaster.
Do you wish the invasion had never happened?
It's really difficult to answer because we chose war at that time and now we wish it wouldn't have happened.
Well, the north where you're from, Kurdistan, has been a semi-autonomous region for the past 16 years, and it hasn't suffered from the same level of violence as other parts of Iraq. It's not had the Sunni-Shia sectarian fighting. What do the Kurds think about all the violence south of them?
What the Kurds think about what's happening in the rest of Iraq is disappointing to me. They don't care about what's going on in the rest of Iraq. I have been talking to them. I have done stories about that. And they say we don't care. It's a fire that's burning the rest of Iraq. As long as we are safe and secure here, we shouldn't care about that. And one reason is that the Kurdish people in the north of Iraq have been trying for decades to gain independence for their part of Iraq, but they couldn't because they were suppressed by Saddam's government. And now, since they have had this semi-autonomous state for the past 16 years, they say, then that's it. We suffered enough under the Arab rule or Saddam's government. And now I think they pay back for what they did to us, which is a wrong idea, but that's what they think.
Do they not see that if the rest of Iraq falls apart, there's a good chance that it will bleed into their area?
They don't see that, and their opinion about the rest of Iraq or the Iraq situation is not realistic, I believe, because Kurdistan is not an independent country and it is not internationally recognized as an independent state. It is still part of Iraq, and what's going on in the rest of Iraq affects the Kurdistan situation directly, but people don't see that very much.
You know, there's a chance that there are some who are thinking, well, let the Sunnis and the Shias destroy each other and leave us, you know, the area. But I'm wondering, are you worried that if U.S. forces pull out and the civil war widens, that it will consume the Kurds?
That's true. That's a good question, because there isn't a guarantee what will happen to the Kurdish secure and safe state they have at the moment, because the Kurdish people went into war against Iraq and they allied with America without any agreement. They didn't have a signed agreement on a paper saying this is what is going to happen to the Kurds in Iraq. Until this moment, Kurds are despised by people in the Arab world and in Iraq for their coalition with the Americans. And they say you are American puppets, you led the Americans, helped the Americans come into Iraq. All of this resentment increased in the past years. And if the American troops withdraw from Iraq, as you said, then Kurds are left alone.
That's a grim prediction from Ayub Nouri. He's a 28-year-old journalist from the Iraqi region of Kurdistan with his point of view on the fourth anniversary of the American invasion of Iraq. We're going to ask him more about that. But first, we have more from today's poll released by ABC News, USA Today, the BBC, and German TV. It says, first of all, it finds that only 18% of Iraqis have confidence in U.S. coalition troops. 86% are concerned that someone in their household will be a victim of violence. Interestingly, about 80% oppose the presence of U.S. troops, but only a third want U.S. troops to leave Iraq immediately, maybe with the same thinking that Ayub just expressed. And 95% of Kurds view their security positively, the opposite of Baghdad residents. So we'll have more from Ayub. And don't forget, later in the program, is that deadline for Northern Ireland serious? That's still ahead here and now. Young, it's here and now.
At this point in the war, our most important mission is helping the Iraqis secure their capital. Until Baghdad's citizens feel secure in their own homes and neighborhoods, it will be difficult for Iraqis to make further progress toward political reconciliation or economic rebuilding.
President Bush speaking today, and as we just heard, many Iraqis don't feel safe. We're talking to 28-year-old Ayub Nouri, a journalist from the Iraqi region of Kurdistan, studying journalism now at Columbia University. And Ayub, I'm wondering, do you sometimes feel uncomfortable because you now, you know, you've come to a country that's waged a war that, as you just told us, you now wish had never happened?
Yes. When I came here, I have mixed feelings about America, because, and I feel really sad because foreign policies of the American government, especially Bush administration, has alienated millions of people around the world. and made people not distinguish between the American people and the American policymakers. Now, in the past several years, people outside the world, especially in the Middle East, look at everyone in America the same. But when I come here, I see that there are millions of Americans who are against this administration, and they don't like the idea of invading Iraq, and they don't like the mess.
Well, and there are some Americans who would argue that, the best intentions were at play.
Yes, but in reality, there are many other countries in the world who are suffering under dictatorship, and they are friends with America. Why America is not going to overthrow those regimes? Why it was only Saddam's regime that had to be taken out in the Middle East? It is hypocrisy. If they think that people should be free and live in freedom, there are other regimes, as I said, in Asia, in Africa, and other countries that get support from the American government directly. That's what makes us think that the intention was not good. The intention was, it was a political motivation, and they had their own agenda to go into war with Iraq. And second of all, it's not the responsibility of another country to go thousands of miles with 140,000 troops to change a regime or to bring change. Did you make sure the people in this country want you? Did you make sure you can understand the culture, the religion, the historical background of that country before going there? You cannot make decisions on your own part and trying to carry it out.
Well, Ayub, I just want to gently remind you that you were the one who said that you did want the U.S. to come in and remove Saddam Hussein. I mean, if things had gone well, you wouldn't be saying that.
I wouldn't be saying that, but under no occupation in history things have been going well. Countries for thousands of years have been occupied by other countries, colonized, and bloodshed and killing, and later on left. But Iraqi people in that case, including me, we were disappointed. We had lost every hope that we could take things into our own hands. The Americans came and they could do something. At least they could do something. But they made so many mistakes. They didn't listen to anyone. They had no idea what they were doing. They were not familiar with anything else. But when somebody is drowning in a sea or in an ocean, you try even to hold on to a straw or something to save. That's what made us hopeful about the war.
Now, as you meet more and more Americans, do you think there's something the Americans can do, or is it all political?
At this moment, sadly, everything is beyond the control of the Americans in Iraq. When I look at the situation, the Americans, I see them as bystanders, and they look at the streets of Iraq, and what's happening is completely a power struggle between the different religious sects or political parties. The Americans have no influence over the situation at this moment because it's a sectarian violence. It happens in Shia-Sunni neighborhood. It's a struggle between the militia groups of the same political leaders who are involved in the Iraqi government. They go to the Iraqi government, they say, we are working for the unity of Iraq and to keep Iraq together, but their behavior in the streets of Iraq tells a completely different thing. They have militias, they have power, and if they cannot reach an agreement in the government, they can use their power in the streets. It is, what I see is everybody in Iraq, especially the Shias and the Sunnis, see the situation as a golden opportunity, and they want to decide and guarantee their future now, as long as the Americans are there. The Americans have become an umbrella to the Iraqi power struggle, and everybody wants, they say, as long as the Americans are here and their heavy military presence here, let's make sure we gain the power, and once they leave, we are the one to rule Iraq. And this is the result of this power struggle that we see. Millions of refugees, sectarian violence, people being killed and thrown into the streets of Baghdad.
You're at Columbia University, where you may be hearing about the Iraq War, but I'm wondering, are you surprised at how little everyday Americans really, seem to be impacted by it on a daily basis?
Because there has been so much news and coverage of Iraq in the past, and not good coverage, but I mean so much news about Iraq and the bombings and the killings, people get disappointed and they say, I don't want, sometimes even myself, that I am so much concerned about Iraq and the future of Iraq, I sometimes avoid watching or reading the news for a day or two because you can't take that. It's too much to handle. At some point, this is what I feel sometimes, and let alone the Americans. Although they feel concerned also about Iraq or what their government is doing there. But if I don't blame them if they sometimes avoid watching the news.
Hmm. By the way, we understand you have 2 months left on your study visa at Columbia. Then what? Are you going to go home?
I personally would like to go back to Iraq because my family is there and Iraq is going through all of this hardship. I believe it is the time that Iraq needs me to work as a journalist, but it is very dangerous. I might go back to Iraq and live safely all my life and I might get killed the first day I get back there. That's the situation. So I might stay here in America for a while and wait and hope that the situation improves back home.
Ayub Nouri, 28 years old. He's a journalist from the Iraqi region of Kurdistan. He's studying journalism now at Columbia University. And Ayub, thanks for speaking to us on this, the fourth anniversary of the invasion of Iraq.
You are welcome.
In this quick note, tomorrow on Here and Now, a new film looks at an old whodunit. Can the IRA help solve America's largest art heist here at Boston's Isabella Stewart Gardner Museum? That's tomorrow. Ahead, the IRA and the new government in Northern Ireland. That's after the news. Here and Now. Support of Young, it's Here and Now. Later this half hour, before Christine Jorgensen, there was Michael Dillon, a look at the history of sex change. That's later. But first, a week from today, that's the deadline Prime Minister Tony Blair has given rival Protestant and Catholic politicians to hammer out a power-sharing agreement in Northern Ireland, or Blair will completely dissolve the new government and bring back British rule. The Reverend Ian Paisley, whose Protestant Democratic Unionist Party won the most votes in the recent election, says he won't meet the deadline unless the Catholic Sinn Féin Party agrees to work with the local police. But Sinn Féin points to past cases of the predominantly Protestant police force participating in violence against Catholics. The party says its followers have cooperated with police to solve crimes, but Sinn Féin officials also have indicated they might not work with the police against Catholics still opposed to the peace process who might provoke attacks. Well, David Hanson is a member of the British Parliament who serves as Minister of State for Northern Ireland. He's visited Boston and joined us in the studio to talk about the ongoing political process there. David, is it possible that when things have come so far since the Good Friday agreements of a decade ago, that the British government would just throw this newly elected government out if the deadline isn't met?
Well, we've been at this 10 years, Robin. We've been trying to get the parties together to form a devolved government over that 10-year period. And now is the time.
So what's happening behind the scenes? I mean, is Sinn Féin, is Gerry Adams being prodded to say something about how they might work with the police, or what's happening?
Well, we've got to do two things. We've got to get trust, really, on both sides. The unionist community want to have the trust that the Sinn Féin party will work with the police on day-to-day matters such as robberies, burglaries, rape, murder.
But they say they're doing that.
I think what there needs to be is the confidence that they're going to continue to do that, and I think that will happen. And on the other side, the Republicans and the Nationalists want to have confidence that Ian Paisley really does mean that he will share power with them as elected politicians. Now, I think both will happen. The 26th of March is a deadline, but we can't go on and on and on. This is the deadline. This is the end of the road. People have to share power. People have to sign up to policing, or else we will close it down.
Is the sticking point the fact that Sinn Féin also won't declare that it will go after dissidents, people who aren't in the flock, who haven't gone along with the peace process, who might now launch attacks. Is that the sticking point? Explain to us what the issues are there.
Well, I think that the trust element is really, are the Republican movement supportive of the police in all its manifestations?
Because we should say there's more than one movement on the Catholic Irish side.
There is, yeah. There's the Social Democratic Labour Party have already signed up to policing in the broader sense. Sinn Féin have said they will do so. They've passed a historic motion. And I think what the unionist community wants is visible evidence of that. Now, I believe that can happen. But people are concerned that not just on robberies and burglaries and day-to-day muggings and issues such as that, but also on the wider political issues, such as dissident Republicans, such as ammunition, such as people outside of the political process. Will the Republican movement meet the mark? Now, I believe they will, but confirmation of that is really the nub of the next week.
What's at stake here? Tony Blair again has said that if the deadline isn't met, he'll dissolve the new government. The British government will get more involved, as will the Irish government in Dublin. Who doesn't want what? I mean, I know Ian Paisley doesn't want the British government more involved. Does the British British government want to be involved again?
Well, what we want is to have local people elected, as in the Massachusetts state legislature, to run local affairs. At the moment, I'm a member of parliament in the House of Commons, running, like the federal government would do, the Massachusetts affairs on behalf of people who can't come to conclusions on their responsibilities. We have to put local power back with local people. And the purpose of the next week is to get that assembly up and running so that housing, transport, education, health are dealt with locally in Northern Ireland. If it doesn't happen, the downside for the people of Northern Ireland is they will not have that local democracy. They'll have members of parliament running their affairs. We'll have greater cooperation with the Irish government on cross-border issues. That will end democracy in Northern Ireland in terms of the local election for a long, long period to come.
On the other hand, if the deadline's met and things progress, how does the British government feel, really, about a government in Northern Ireland that includes remnants of the IRA? I mean, some of this is astonishing. The former IRA commander, Martin McGuinness, will be second in charge with Ian Paisley. Gerry Kelly, a former hunger striker, jailed for his part in IRA bombings in Britain, will, you know, be in this government.
Isn't that a good, positive thing? Isn't it going to be a good, positive thing that, I mean, for a whole of my adult life, I have seen and met with people who've been killed, maimed, wounded, murdered in Northern Ireland through the conflict, from the British Army, from individuals from the IRA. Now, isn't it better to have a situation whereby people are putting their democratic mandate that they've now got to the test in running those issues? People will still be looking to the British government and people will still be looking to Irish unity, but they're going to work together. The war is over, peace and prosperity for the interests of people in Northern Ireland. That has to be better than the past 30 years.
It's worth examining on other levels too, because we're watching, as you well know, other stories unfold around the globe of sectarian violence in Iraq, in the Middle East, and, you know, people want to know, well, how does the average person in Britain feel about people who were behind IRA bombings, car bombings, bank bombings, Scotland Yard bombings, now possibly being in government?
It is difficult for all sections of the community to accept a range of issues, but I think we have to look at it as positive developments. People have put the war behind them. There's the potential for a shared future in Northern Ireland, which has never been the case for the past 30 years. People looking at individuals, respect, understanding, tolerance of people's lives. And that, I think, has to be better than what I've grown up with, which is, you know, soldiers being murdered, policemen being murdered, IRA volunteers being killed, the troubles as we've seen them. The future has to be that shared basis, and I think every opportunity is there to make it happen.
And of course, I want to note that many of the Irish might feel the same way about Ian Paisley now heading their government. You're nodding as if, yeah.
Ian Paisley has had a history in Northern Ireland which has put forward very strong views. Gerry Adams and Martin McGuinness have done the same. The very fact they can now share government, take joint decisions, is a very positive outcome.
Well, the wounds of the past, as you've said, are here, and families on both sides of the Protestant-Catholic divide in Northern Ireland feel that the British Army and the Northern Ireland Police were involved in the deaths of their loved ones. And some have been in Washington to ask the Bush administration to put pressure on the British government because they aren't satisfied with the British response to some of their claims. Do you think the British government has done enough? Have you done enough? And is there the need for some kind of a South African-like reconciliation trial, perhaps?
We've got to look at all those issues, certainly in terms of some of the allegations of collusion between the security forces in terms of horrific incidents. We've seen recently a report by the police ombudsman. We've accepted the recommendations on that, and we need to move forward for the future. There is always going to be historical issues, and we have now a historical inquiry team looking at previous incidences of terrorism and other related collusion aspects, and that needs to be looked at again for the future. I think the time will come when we need to look at how we deal with the past, because there are people who have been children, widows, orphans throughout Northern Ireland's past 30 years. They need to come to terms with the past, and they need to make sure that their children for the future have a better life. Mm. Whether we go down the route of a South African model is something we need to look at over the next few years, but it will be something that will be done when the people of Northern Ireland are ready to come to terms with it.
David Hanson, the British government's Minister of State for Northern Ireland, visiting here in the Boston area, and thank you so much for taking some time with us.
Thank you, Rob.
And still to come before we go today, the history of sex changes. It's older than you think. You're listening to Here and Now. As the number of iPods grow, so too has the number of podcasts just exploded. We have a podcast of our show, but some radio or TV shows are delivered only over the Internet rather than over the airwaves. John Kalish reports on a group of young men who do what they call a comedy podcast out of Southern California. Despite its juvenile content, or maybe because of it, it's paying the rent.
Infected.
The podcast is called Infected. It's a little over a year old and has about 50,000 subscribers. The host is Martin Sargent, a 31-year-old former TV personality who records the podcast at his kitchen table with his co-producer Jay Speeden and engineer Joseph Rabier. Together, they tackle a new theme each week. It's a mix of phone interviews with offbeat characters, bizarre trivia games, fabricated stories, and phony commercials. During Infected's first year, shows have dealt with work, fashion, fitness, family, and virility.
I'm Internet's Martin Sargent. And I'm joined, as always, by two of the most lion-hearted, two-fisted guys I know, Joey and the Gator. Hey, what's up, men?
Martin, what's up, man?
Oh, chillin', just being a man, Joe!
Yeah.
In the iTunes store, where a subscription to almost all podcasts is free, Infected carries an explicit warning. That's because there's a lot of sexual content and what broadcasters used to call frank language in the podcast.
Because he lost and because he is the runt of the Infected litter, Joey must now go to the store to get another bottle of Wild Turkey for the alpha males.
No!
We'll be right back with Maddox after these words from our sponsors.
Joey.
Martin Sargent's on-air sidekick is known as the Gator. He's played by Sargent's friend, Jay Speeden. Listeners know the Gator as a man who loves peach schnapps, is fluent in Mandarin, and lives in a truck.
I used to have a rat snake named Jimmy. He crawled into a hole in our drywall and he died in there. And then my dad had to chop the wall out with a hatchet. He pulled Jimmy out and he cut him up on the kitchen floor with that hatchet.
How many of your pets did your dad kill?
Pretty much all of them.
This comedy podcast also has phony entertainment industry coverage, produced by Stuart Engesser, a colleague of Sargent and Speeden's, based in Kennebunkport, Maine. Engesser has a recording studio housed in what was a chicken coop on his property. He does a character named Johnny O'Banion.
This is Johnny O'Banion coming to you live from the tippity-tippity top of lovely Laurel Canyon, Los Angeles, California, with all the entertainment news you need to know.
Infected, which is offered in both audio and video versions, is part of the lineup at Revision3.com, a web-based TV network that specializes in edgy entertainment, including the Dignation podcast, which was recently listed as number 84 on iTunes' Top 100 Podcasts. In addition to the Revision 3 funding, Infected has a sponsor, a web hosting company called GoDaddy. Again, podcast host Martin Sargent.
You get people like myself and the Gator and Joey saying, yeah, use GoDaddy.com. That holds a whole lot more weight than just some random commercial that comes up in between segments, even on The Daily Show. But when we do commercials on this show, those are oftentimes the funniest parts of the show.
Infected by Martin Sargent is brought to you by the Olive Garden, home of the never-ending salads.
Food has always been celebrated in Italy. The Romans were famous for their lavish feasts and salads. Now you can enjoy the same at the Olive Garden.
Did Romans really eat that much salad?
Gee, here comes the waiter.
More salads?
I'm really bullish on this whole medium.
Once again, Martin Sargent.
It's just really exciting to be able to do precisely what you want to do, exactly what you want to do. This is a revolution, this podcasting thing. Anyone can do this. Anyone can sit around their own kitchen table with very little equipment and reach potentially a worldwide audience. That is really liberating.
Sargent is also reaching an audience via cell phones in a 3-minute daily video show. A couple of episodes of a pilot he did for Comedy Central can be seen on the web at revision3.com/webdrifter.
Reporter John Kalish on what I guess 15-year-olds are listening to. For more on the podcast Infected and on ours, go to our website, here-now.org. More ahead, here and now.
Infected.
Young, it's here and now. Over 60 years ago, when plastic surgery was in its infancy and the effects of the hormones estrogen and testosterone were just beginning to be studied, Laura Dillon, a well-born English lady, wanted desperately to become an English lord. After years of misery and cross-dressing, she began taking testosterone and then underwent surgery that transformed her into Michael Dillon. But Michael Dillon still yearned for love and spiritual fulfillment. Would he find it? His story is now being told in the new book, The First Man-Made Man, the story of two sex changes, one love affair, and a 20th century medical revolution. And it is literally the history of sex changes. And author Pagan Kennedy is here to tell us more. Welcome.
Hi.
Well, Michael Dillon. Now, some people might say, wait a second, your title is The First Man-Made Man. I thought that was Christine Jorgensen, in other words, the first sex change in 1952-1953, the American man who went to Copenhagen and came back a woman.
That was generally the first sex change that people were aware about, and part of that was because the Christine Jorgensen story just exploded in the press. The first person who's considered to have had a sex change from male to female was Lily Elbe.
Whose male name was?
Whose male name was Einar Wagener.
And this was in the 1930s?
1920s and 1930s. And how the story went was, so there was this Danish artist, Einar, who began going around to doctors and saying, there's a woman inside of me named Lily. At the time, doctors had just begun to realize the effects of estrogen and testosterone in the body.
And you remind us, I mean, you take us back to the early studies where doctors were saying there might be something in these organs. There might be some sort of hormone that, and they didn't know this in, you know, the 1920s.
And then they understood very little. Another thing that they didn't have the conception that we do now of gender as something that can exist solely in the brain. So they thought that if this man, who appeared to be completely physiologically an ordinary man, if he was making this complaint, he must have, this femaleness must exist somewhere inside of him. So they assumed he had ovaries. Now, they never saw these ovaries, but they decided they would zap these imaginary ovaries with x-rays to rejuvenate his ovaries. Well, that didn't work. And so Einar had a number of what we would call like the bottom operation. I won't get too technical on public radio, but basically had a number of operations.
Well, that brings us to, you know, the 40s and 50s and Laura Dillon's story. And you tell us the story of this beautiful, tall, striking, wealthy woman from an important British family who felt from an early age that she was male. At this point, testosterone has been discovered and she discovers it as well.
She was the first person in a female body to take testosterone with the intention of becoming male that we have on record, and then met not just the best plastic surgeon in England, but pretty much the only plastic surgeon. There were so few plastic surgeons at this time.
I think you're right, 60 at one point. And the practice began, really, they were these gods of World War I because they were working on these poor, disfigured soldiers who'd come back from the war. And then they seemed, I mean, tell us more about the role of the doctors in this, the transsexual movement. They seemed so much more compassionate than other people.
The plastic surgeons were. The other doctors didn't get it. And, I mean, I think what's really important and amazing about Michael Dillon himself is that he was living in a time where the word transsexual, transgendered, all of that didn't exist. In fact, people didn't even use the word gendered. Laura Dillon, you know, was wearing men's clothes, riding a motorcycle, and was spit on, vilified, made fun of, and really had that huge need to have the legal male identity just so he could, you know, have an ordinary life.
Well, he will at one point begin a series of operations. But in the meantime, your subtitle is A Love Affair, the story of two sex changes and a love affair. Michael Dillon meets a man who wants to become a woman, and that's Roberta Cowell. Michael Dillon at this point has also become a doctor and falls in love with the man who's about to become a woman to the extent that he actually performs her operation.
That's right. Robert Cowell, who had been this somewhat famous race car driver, but was now transitioning to Roberta. And Roberta was, now this is 1950, so Roberta was able to get estrogen and had transformed her appearance quite a bit.
But given that this was Robert trying to become Roberta, enter a new problem. Britain had a law, the Mayhem Statute?
Yes. In most of the Western countries, there were these laws on the books. Some doctors were not supposed to cut off any part of a man's body.
That would prevent him from being a soldier.
Exactly. And these were just old laws on the books. But the surgeons were well aware of them and realized if they were to help those people, that they would be put in jail, not to mention lose their rights to practice as doctors and all of that. And so Roberta's situation, she now, you know, you should picture her as this kind of a Marilyn Monroe lookalike. She's taken a lot of estrogen. She looks fabulous. And they meet for lunch in 1950. She does not know about his history. She only sees him as this doctor who might be able to help her get the castration that she needs in order to go ahead with the rest of her surgeries. And Michael Dillon falls head over heels in love with her and confesses in the space of that lunch his own history, that he was once a woman.
And this is all on record. You found papers and letters.
I found papers. Roberta Cowell writes about it in her autobiography.
Well, it becomes heartbreaking because he, Michael Dillon, who was once a woman, Laura Dillon, performs the surgery on Robert Cowell so that he can physically become Roberta Cowell. But then Roberta Cowell, this beautiful woman, turns down Michael Dillon's proposal, and off he goes to yet another whole chapter in his life. He becomes a ship's doctor, travels the world, becomes caught up in religion, eventually studies in India, aspires to be a Tibetan monk. But he's not even considered a full man by the monks.
Yeah.
And it just, his story ends so very sad.
You know, but I feel that he did. I mean, I think what's sad is he died in the Himalayas of some kind of mysterious ailment. And at that moment, he actually, I think had he only been able to live 10 years longer, this would have been a happier story because he was on the verge of so many things. First of all, he was one of the first Westerners to really get involved with Tibetan Buddhism. And the Tibetan Buddhists were on the verge of allowing him to become a full-fledged monk. He had this had written the story of his life, and just before he died, he had sent it to his agent in London to have it published. Had he lived, he might well have been the male Christine Jorgensen, the person who stepped forward and became a role model. When I was growing up in the 70s, I didn't know it was possible for a woman to become a man. You know,
and they had.
Yes, there were many people who had transitioned. There was complete silence in the media about it. And so had there been that role model, had there been his autobiography, things might have turned out very differently. And of course, it would have been a very painful road for him, but very heroic.
Yes, it might have been Michael Dillon, known for paving the way for others, long before Christine Jorgensen. Well, Pagan Kennedy tells Michael's story now in The First Man-Made Man, the story of two sex changes, one love affair, and a 20th century medical revolution. Pagan, thank you.
Thank you.
Here and Now is a production of WBUR Boston. I'm Robin Young. Please join us again here and now.
Funding for Here and Now comes from the MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, on the web at mathworks.com.
PRI, Public Radio International.